is it possible for good people to make a mistake? You know, a few weeks ago, actually toward the end of summer, we had some headline stories running rather prominently for a while, centering, interestingly enough, on the Ten Commandments. Down in Montgomery, Alabama, there was the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court that had caused to bring in several hundred pounds worth of stone in which were carved the Ten Commandments. And a federal judge says that's a violation of the separation of church and state. You've got to get those out of a public place. And there was a lot of discussion about that. And I'll be perfectly frank, when those commandments were removed from a public place, notwithstanding everything I know about end time events and religious liberty and all the rest of it, a part of me felt bad. You know, you think about it. Our children are bombarded in public schools, if that's where they attend, with evolution taught not as a theory, but as a fact. They're bombarded with this stuff. They come home and the trash that comes from my hometown of Hollywood feeds through the television set into their souls, and seldom are the children of this country exposed to something as uplifting as the Ten Commandments. So here was this little drama playing out down in the Supreme Court building there in Montgomery, Alabama. And it was rather interesting. The writer for USA Today put a kind of a melodramatic flair on his story, and he put it this way. Hundreds of people were crowded into the portico of the court building. The sound of speeches echoed loudly among the building's tall columns. The soft singing of psalms could be heard. Thunder rolled in the distance and lightning rippled the dark sky. He was really getting into his topic, wasn't he? And then he quoted a pastor from Alabama. Quoted the man he identified as the Reverend Henry Ledbetter of Haleyville, Alabama, who said, when this, in other words, the Ten Commandments, when this goes out of here, some of the glory of God is going to depart this rotunda. Ten Commandments being hauled out of public life. And I'll confess, a part of me felt bad to see the law of God removed from public display. So the question I pose to you again is it possible for good people, people who love the Bible and love the Ten Commandments and believe in all the things we also believe in, is it possible for them to make an unintentional mistake? Well, go back, if you will, to the winter of 1636, and Massachusetts Bay Colony had just been formed. I mean, it had begun just less than 20 years before the Mayflower had dropped anchor there in Massachusetts Bay. And the colony had been settled by people, most of whom were Puritans, which meant they were reformers, they were fundamentalists, they believed in the Bible. They stood on this book as opposed to the party line given them by some of the established state churches in England and in Europe. In other words, they were good people serious about following the Word of God. And they left England and boarded a couple of ships, one of which was inappropriately named the Speedwell. Well, the Speedwell didn't speed so good. It was a leaky old tub. And twice it sprang a leak and they had to flee back to Southampton, England. Finally, they realized the Speedwell wasn't going anywhere. So they chartered the Mayflower. Came across the Atlantic. By this time, the delays had pushed them into the equinoctial storm season of the North Atlantic, and they went through horrific danger just to get to the shores of North America, because they were looking for what? Religious liberty. Thank the Lord for religious liberty. That's why we can be here today, without fear of interference. Thank the Lord for this country. Well, these good people who believed in the Word of God and who had fled from religious oppression got to the shores of Massachusetts Bay, and guess what the first thing was they did? After getting their clothing ashore and building some kind of rude shelters, they began establishing religious laws and enforcing them with the civil power of the state. And as the colony developed and began to have ships coming and going, the story goes that one day a sea captain returned to Massachusetts Bay Colony. He'd been gone for something like 2 years, And he got home, and there, bless her heart, was his wife, and she looked pretty good to him. And he went up there in public and gave her a big kiss, but the only problem was this was Sunday, and you didn't do stuff like that in public on Sunday. You know what happened to that sea captain? That was the last he saw of his wife for the rest of the day. He spent the rest of the day in stocks for having desecrated the Sabbath. Well, things like that would happen. In those days, it wasn't a question of, am I going to church next Sunday? You would be there. You were expected to be there. And you would stay awake during the service, which, by the way, may be a challenge for you this afternoon. Because, once again, the ladies of Texas have proved themselves, haven't they? Thank you for a wonderful potluck. I really enjoyed the food. It's always good to come home. The only thing I regret is that by the time I got there, if there ever were any black-eyed peas, they were already taken. Now, I'm a real descendant of a Texan, you understand, and to me, black-eyed peas are an essential part of a meal. But anyway, thank you, ladies, for a wonderful dinner. Well, you would go to church in Massachusetts Bay Colony, and you would stay awake. And to ensure that you did, the deacons would be patrolling the aisles, and they had a long rod, hardwood rod, on the end of which had been turned a kind of a knob. And if you fell asleep and you were a man, that knob would contact your cranium with sufficient authority that you would give up the idea of sleeping. Now, they were a little nicer to the ladies. The other end of the stick had a feather on it. If a lady fell asleep, they would use the feather. But in either event, you woke up. Well, it wasn't everybody got along in Massachusetts Bay Colony. And one of the fellows who didn't get along was a man by the name of Roger Williams. And he had roused the ire of his Puritan neighbors with some strange notions, one of which was he defended Native American land rights. He said, we shouldn't be coming here and just taking this land from the Native Americans. They were here first. We should buy it from them. Well, that didn't go over very well. What really sealed his doom was when he went on to say, and furthermore, the justices of our local courts shouldn't involve themselves in religious matters. And that did it. And on a December day in 1636, the Puritans finally got enough of Roger Williams, and they just tossed him bodily out of the colony into the deep snow of a New England winter. By some miracle, he made it through the snow, got down to what would become the site of Providence, Rhode Island. First thing he did was purchase the site of Providence from the local Native Americans, and then he bothered to learn the Narragansett language. And as he did this, and as he started the colony of Rhode Island, he said, and I quote, there should ever be a wall of separation between church and state. Well, he was convicted of that because he'd seen what happens when the wall ain't there. Well, a century and a half went by, and once again, travelers were on the move. By this time, there was a United States of America. And in the spring and summer of 1787, they convened in Philadelphia in Constitution Hall. General Washington was up front on the dais with, you know, presiding over the convention, and the rest of the room was filled with little tables where the framers of the Constitution sat, little tables covered with green cloth. By September of that year, they had drafted what, to my way of thinking, is one of the most magnificent documents this world has ever seen. Begins with these words, we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, promote the general welfare, provide for the common defense, and secure to ourselves and our posterity the blessings of liberty, do ordain and establish this Constitution. Folks, it doesn't get much better than that. You don't think that Constitution is important? Go someplace else for a while and come home. Let me pose a question to you. What is the function of a Constitution? Why is it so important to us to have one? What is it designed to do? The most basic thing. What's a Constitution designed to do for you? Pardon? Protect the people. Yeah. And a little more specifically? Pardon? Individual rights, sure. The function of a constitution is to protect the minority from the majority. Okay? We clear on that? See, in a pure democracy, 51% of the people can say, well, we're all going to start going to church on Thursday, because it seems like that would be a neat idea. And in a pure democracy, because 51% vote that, you see, you're stuck with that. Will you believe it or not? So because there is always a minority that can be hurt by the majority, the role of a constitution is to say, you can have majority vote, but we're going to have this document protecting those who maybe disagree. Okay? That's the function of a constitution. And no sooner had the Constitution been formed than some amendments were added to it, the first of which said, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. There were some other very important amendments, such as the fourth, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, papers, houses, and effects shall not be unreasonably infringed, the right to privacy, something very precious to us. So the Constitution was formed, and one of the framers of the Constitution was Thomas Jefferson, and in about 1815, 1817, I forget the exact year, he wrote a letter to the Baptist Association up in Danbury, Connecticut, and he once again echoed Roger Williams' words when he said, there must always be a wall of separation between church and state. And from that time until very recently, there has been a clear wall of separation between church and state. However, the pioneers of Adventism 150 years ago began looking in the Word of God, reading Revelation 12, 13, 14, and came to the conclusion that the time would come when liberty would disappear from the world because of a failed attempt at international globalism, which would bring on a time of crisis such as the world had never seen. So they began to warn a long time ago that somewhere in the future, just before Jesus returned, we would see a world in which liberty disappeared. And a frightened majority would willingly give up liberty, and thus the minority would lose its protection. And there would be a stubborn minority who insisted on following this book. And they would be misunderstood by the world and feared. And Jesus said, "Ye shall be hated of all men for my name's sake." And ultimately, Revelation 13 says what? And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark, and that none might buy or sell, save he that had the name, the mark, or the number. Collapse of liberty. That's what our pioneers thought they saw coming. Now, with that little preface as to the importance of our Constitution and the wonderful country that it has given us, let's move ourselves now into the present day and let's look at some of the challenges our wonderful country faces and law enforcement faces today, because they're confronting problems that almost defy human solution. Let me pose a hypothetical to you. Supposing you were a federal officer and you have taken into custody an individual who clearly was a terrorist. You knew that because pursuant either to a valid arrest or to a warrant issued by a court, you had searched his possessions and you had discovered papers on him which describe the next September 11. They reveal that that event, that act of terror, will occur just 24 hours from now, this time tomorrow. They reveal that this time it'll be a dirty bomb and that a whole section of a city, an American city, is going to be uninhabitable for 50 years when the thing goes off. Thousands will die. The only thing the papers do not tell you is where it's going to happen. You know when, you know how, but you don't know where. It's vital to know where. If you can figure out where, you can get the people out of there, maybe, and at least save lives. So you take him to the interrogation room. Maybe you read him his rights, if Miranda even applies in a situation like that. And then you ask him questions. Where is it going to happen? And his reply to you with a sneer is, "Allahu Akbar, God is great." That's all he said. 20 minutes go by. Now it's no longer 24 hours till the dirty bomb. It's less than a day. You keep asking him questions. You aren't getting to first base, so you call in a colleague in law enforcement who's very good at interrogation. He tries his luck. He doesn't get to first base. Now it's 23 hours till this thing goes off, and you're getting nowhere. And you know that if you can't get him to talk, thousands of innocent people will die. Now, Mr. or Ms. Federal Officer, at this point, what are you tempted to do? Huh? You're tempted to to do the T word, torture. Right? Talk about torture for just a little bit. In the Middle Ages, people knew exactly what they were going to do with those who frightened them or in some way seemed to jeopardize the majority. They had an array of devices designed to extract cooperation even from the most uncooperative. One of them was a device called the Iron Maiden. It was like a mummy case, you know, that would open up in the form of a hollow human body, and it was on hinges, and you could shut the thing. You could put a person inside this thing and slam it shut and lock it shut. The only problem was that inside this thing were a bunch of spikes, so that when the thing slammed shut, it was distinctly user-unfriendly. Another thing they had was a sort of a sawhorse. It was very sharp. I saw these things on display out in San Diego. There's a museum of torture that's an Italian foundation because they are very concerned about the inhumanity of man to man in past eras. They've assembled these medieval instruments, the actual things that were used to torture people, itinerate around the country, and they're put on display. And I saw them in the Museum of Man in San Diego. And I saw this sawhorse with a very sharp ridge, about 4 feet long, up just high enough so your feet couldn't touch the ground. They would put you astride that thing. That could get very uncomfortable very quickly. Then they would start adding weights to your shoulders. Another thing was called a head crusher. I mean, it went on the head. There was a thing went on the head, a thing under your chin, and they would just keep screwing that thing down until awful things happened to you. In the Middle Ages, people played tough. Torture, throughout most of human history, has been routinely used to extract cooperation from people that society feared. But on a September day in 1787, along came this document, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union." And the Eighth Amendment of that Constitution says, and I quote, "Excessive bail shall not be required, nor cruel and unusual punishment inflicted." Now you think about it. At least 6 or 7 of the first 10 amendments of the Constitution are designed to make it impossible for anything like an Inquisition ever to happen in America. You follow me? Freedom of religion, a free press, you know, looking over the shoulder of government, the right of the people to bear arms. I recognize this thing is much in conflict today, but my son did some research on this thing, frankly, because he wanted to make some money. The National Rifle Association had a contest out for law students all over the country to write a paper on the Second Amendment. He wrote it, and he won. Got himself $5,000 and a letter from the NRA of thanks for the thing. He discovered something interesting, and I hadn't realized this till I looked at his research. In 19th century America, the first cases to come down denying the right of the people to keep and bear arms affected not white America, but black America. Are you aware of that? There were some black Americans down south trying to exercise their right to vote. African Americans didn't go over real well in those days in the south. And a kind of a lynch mob came along. The black Americans were armed for their own defense. They had to be. The whites took the arms away from them, and the federal government sought to bring an action against those whites for deprivation of the right of African Americans under the Second Amendment to keep and bear arms. Thing went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court invented this idea that the Bill of Rights wasn't applicable to actions by the states. You know what happened? Immediately, Southern states saw the opportunity of doing state action to deny African Americans of their rights because the Constitution didn't apply to state action, and the result of that was the Jim Crow laws of the late 19th century. So, I don't mean to make a big deal out of the Second Amendment except to say that it's interesting to see that things like Plessy versus Ferguson, which, you know, brought in the idea of separate but equal being okay, flowed right on the heels of the collapse of the Second Amendment. Something I hadn't realized. My son did the research and we discovered that. So the Second Amendment, an armed public, is harder to enslave than would be a disarmed public. Fourth Amendment, the right to privacy, the right not to have your papers and effects intruded into by government. Fifth Amendment, the right to counsel, a right not to incriminate yourself. On and on, the first 10 amendments, many of them are designed to ensure that an inquisition could not happen in America. So torture became something that the Eighth Amendment specifically prohibited. But now here we find ourselves in the aftermath of terrorism. And here's the problem. Let me kind of diagram it here. It might make a little simpler. Here is the United States of America. Over here is the guilty terrorist who seeks to harm the United States. We need to get at him, but he hides behind the shield of the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment, for example. The right to privacy protected in large measure the terrorists of September 11. You see, the problem that we face in this country is to get at this guy, to shoot at this guy, we've got to shoot through the document behind which he's protected. We blow holes in the Constitution. The question then becomes, do those holes remain for the rest of us? There is the problem. That's what terrorism has done. In a sense, terrorism has kind of pushed us into a corner, as if, facing these hard problems, we keep advancing our law enforcement efforts in ways that seems to kind of begin to compress constitutional rights. That's the dilemma we face. And it'd be very, very easy to look at this and be very critical of government, very critical of law enforcement, but ladies and gentlemen, think about the challenges they face and the job they have to do. That's the dilemma we face. My conviction is that this thing wasn't just dreamed up by Osama bin Laden. It's too brilliant for him. This thing is Luciferian. In my opinion, this thing is the devil's way to bring on the collapse of liberty that Revelation predicts. That's why last night I said that I think radical Islam and terrorism are a catalyst that kind of help to accelerate end time events. All right. We're being pushed into a corner where liberty is being challenged. It shouldn't come as a surprise to us. Adventists have looked in the Word of God and seen this coming for a century and a half. We happen to be the generation that gets to see it happen. Which tells me we just may be the generation fortunate enough to see the Lord come. Now, I recognize that it's very easy for people to stand up in a pulpit and preach this kind of stuff and maybe seem to be a little bit over the top, you know, sensationalizing things that maybe aren't as bad as they're made out to be. So let me share with you now some second opinions on some of the challenges to liberty we face in this country. And once again, I don't read to audiences stuff from the National Enquirer. I try to go to scholarly sources that I could put my weight on if I had to try a case in court. What I'm going to be sharing with you comes from a military warfighting journal. I'm a member of the Naval Institute. I get their proceedings every month, and every month we have a lot of scholarly articles written by various officers in the armed forces and non-commissioned officers as well, suggesting problems we face and how wars are fought. Well, after September 11, they branched out and began talking about how we deal with the problem of terrorism and how we harmonize that with liberty. What I'm going to read to you was written by two professors of political science at the Naval Academy. These are not fringe element folks saying fringe element things. They're professors at the Naval Academy, and here's what they had to say. The price of globalization may include a need to compromise some of our most sacred values. Freedom, while the main source of our strength, also makes us vulnerable. And it does, doesn't it? You know, there are certain risks inherent in living in a free country. Americans, they said, may find it necessary to accept restrictions on their liberties to ensure protection from violence and fear. Now, focus on the next sentence. This begs the question of whether the concept of freedom as conceived by our founding fathers is applicable to today's borderless society. End of quote. What have you just heard? You have heard two professors at the Naval Academy saying the concept of freedom as enunciated by the framers of our Constitution may no longer be applicable to the society we live in today. Collapse of the Constitution. Doesn't mean it's going to happen, but what bothers me is that there are people in responsible places saying stuff like that. Let me share another one with you. Same issue. This is the Journal of the Naval Institute, the Proceedings of the Naval Institute, November 2001. This one was written by a fellow who served on the staff of the administrative assistant to the Secretary of the Army. So he was in government. Again, he's not an irresponsible person. And he put it this way. The West must be prepared to institutionalize a passport society. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, in the 80s, when there was still a Soviet Union, I traveled there, and I discovered that even citizens of the USSR could not travel within their own country unless they had a passport, because Big Brother wanted to know where you were and what you were doing. What he is saying is that we may have to institute that in America so that even American citizens traveling within the country would need to have a passport in order to have permission to travel. Now, in the old days, the passport in Russia and the Soviet Union was just a paper book like we're used to. In today's digitalized era, what would a passport society look like? Well, you're looking at it right there. Kind of like a credit card. That's the little magnetic stripe on the back. That's the one we're used to putting in the gas pumps when we pump gas, okay? But on the other side of this thing, in this smart card, which is a prototype smart card and a fairly old one, it's kind of out of date now, you will see that shiny bit of silver on there. That's your CD-ROM segment, okay? That can hold several thousand pages. And over here on the left-hand side is a little silver embedded computer chip. And today's chips can put close to a billion transistors in one square centimeter, which means this rascal holds your whole life history. You're aware now that our current military ID cards are going to this, yeah? So that there are many conveniences associated with this. You can carry your whole medical history with you, your x-rays, your lab reports, all of your hospital charts if you've ever been admitted. Which means if you're traveling out in Utah and you have an accident and they need to treat you, the treating physicians can bring up your medical records here and they can more efficiently take care of it. A lot of good things could come from this. This could hold your driver's license, your record of driving adventures, any criminal history you might have, all of your income tax record. Isn't that comforting? If you're an immigrant, it could hold your immigration status. This thing becomes you. Marital history, you know, the whole thing. Now, assume a circumstance in which things don't go as good. Thank the Lord. Did you, by the way, see what's happening to the economy? This huge upswing in the gross domestic product. You know, it looks like the economy may be turning around. I pray it is. Because the work of God needs funds in order to finish its work, doesn't it? And the 10 years of incredible prosperity we enjoyed in the 90s, we should have used that money to finish the work of God. We could have done it. Instead, we sat in our jacuzzis and watched the big screen TV put us to sleep night after night. Work of God didn't get done, and so he had to remind us with some, you know, hard times that, you know, there's something better than this world that we should be working for. Thank the Lord the economy seems to be recovering, but in a time of a real severe depression, or in a time of terrorism, it's not unreasonable for governmental officials to say, wait a second, one of the problems behind crime and terrorism is that money is too easily transferred between people. You know, the $100 bill is now the medium of exchange for the world's arms dealers, the world's narcotics dealers, and terrorism. Pull that paper out of circulation, digitalize everything, give everybody a card, biometrically encode their identity in this thing so that if your retina doesn't show up when this thing goes through the reader, it just spits it out and says rejected, you know? You could instantaneously get a handle on most crime. Ladies, who would want to steal your purse if this was the only thing you were carrying? How are they going to spend it? See? So there's a lot of arguable advantages for this thing. There's nothing wrong with this technology. Where does the problem come in? Well, what does Revelation say? And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark, and that none could buy or sell. If the monetary system gets put into this thing, this is your only access to the cash register. I think what's happening is we're being set up circumstantially by problems the country faces to go in the direction Revelation 13 predicted. So this fellow who worked for the Assistant Secretary of the Army said, we may have to go to a passport society. But he went further than that. He said, we may have to accept racial profiling. What I think he meant to say is racial and religious profiling. All right, let's talk about that for a second. From a law enforcement standpoint, from the standpoint of preventing crime, it makes perfect sense to do profiling because 100% of the terrorists on September 11 were from an identifiable racial and religious group. So from the standpoint of preventing crime, that makes sense. What's the problem? You start profiling people, and that net can pull in the wrong fish, can't it? Remember last night when I went up here and I showed you on the board the whole list of identifying profiles of the Islamic faith? Think about it. A unique day of worship, the claim to have a prophet, a health message, dress reform, reform of life in terms of entertainment, emphasis on the judgment. You know, all of these things are a distorted version of the Advent message. And the frightened individual in a country that's facing terrorism might not discriminate between the real threat sector and God's people who mean nothing but good for this country. There's the problem. So when you talk about suffering, profiling, there are certain problems that you would encounter. All right. So he says the West must be prepared to institutionalize a passport society, suffer racial profiling, expand search and seizure. Which amendment are we talking about now? Fourth, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects shall not be unreasonably infringed. Let's talk just a little bit about the Fourth Amendment. By the way, right after September 11, a fellow from Houston, believe it or not, wrote a letter to the editor of Time magazine, and he put it this way, when the Constitution was drafted, we did not have dirty bombs, suitcase atomic weapons, computers, or easy worldwide travel. Give me security and take some of my privacy, please. Well, I'm not going to give his name, but he lives in Houston, or did. Now, he says, give me security, take my privacy, please. Well, if he really wants his privacy taken, you know what he can do? It's real simple. All he's got to do is fly to Orlando. Because in the airport there, you know what they got? They have an x-ray machine. It is so sophisticated that its x-rays will easily penetrate human clothing. But they don't penetrate skin. So when you walk through that rascal, guess what happens? I posed that question. My home church was having a little outing out in the hills, and I posed that question to them, and a little fellow about 9 years old in the audience hollered out, they could see your privates real good. Well, if you want to get rid of your privacy, this gentleman in Houston can go to Orlando. That thing is waiting for him, and he can give his privacy up, and he'll have more security. What about the right to privacy? What we're involved with here is a delicate balancing act between the needs of law enforcement, which are increasing and which are very, very valid, and the needs of individuals to be able to have some privacy left. One of the problems we face today in law enforcement is that criminal elements will purchase, you know, off the shelf. You can go to Office Max or a computer store and buy these encryption programs that you can send your messages on the internet in code. And these programs are so very powerful that even the best code-busting gear we have in government won't crack them usually. It's a real problem. So here's all this information going out in code. And the FBI came up with a kind of a neat idea. With the permission of a federal judge, they can get into your computer and insert some kind of a device that records not what letters come out the end of your computer, but the keystrokes you enter. So if you hit a letter G, that captures that keystroke before it ever gets to the encrypting program, so the FBI, with this thing called Magic Lantern, can in fact read in plain language whatever you've typed. Necessary? Probably so under many circumstances, but it shows the way in which technology is forcing the government to become more intrusive. There used to be a program called Carnivore. The government says they've abandoned that or suspended it, but that was one where if you got on the internet and you surfed federal websites, once you went to a federal website, it would then lock onto your computer and it would follow you and keep a record of every other website you ever visited. That could be disturbing, couldn't it? Think about the amount of liberty that terrorism forces us to give up. I recall a few months ago, there was a proposal made by the administration that public officials be on the lookout for anything that didn't look quite right, like postal delivery people, first responders, law enforcement, even neighbors. And it, you know, in a sense, it makes some sense from the standpoint of preventing terrorism. They just said, look, Americans, we're in a war zone. The war has become internalized to this country. Everybody be alert. If you see something doesn't look right, report it. It kind of reminds me, back in the Soviet days, right as the Soviet Union was starting to break up, we had a visitor, a family got out of Russia, and they came to visit us, fine Adventist family, and he's now a very senior official in the church in Moscow. And we were going to send some books back with them, you know, because their libraries there were really needing books, and so we had boxes of books we were going to transfer from the trunk of our car to the trunk of his car. He was parked out on our street in our neighborhood, and we started unloading books, and pretty soon he gets more and more nervous. He finally turns to me and says, won't the neighbors report this? We said, report what? Well, you're giving us all these books. Won't the neighbors report this? And we suddenly realized, Valeri, we aren't in Moscow anymore. We're in California. See? So the problem he faced was, you know, in a very, very closed society, everybody watches everybody. Everybody reports. That may be a good thing if you catch a terrorist, but what if you're doing something otherwise innocent and you become a person of interest? One of the things you don't want to become is a person of interest. So, the right to privacy, a very, very precious thing that we're tending to give up more and more, and many times we just throw it away. That's the sad thing. You know, with these credit cards we use, we create an electronic trail of every place we've been and everything we've bought. You're aware of that, aren't you? You know, when you put your credit card in and it prints your name out on the receipt, along with an itemized list of everything you bought, have you ever wondered, does the computer that did all this have any interest in remembering what I bought? Well, if you wonder about it, the answer is yes. It, in fact, captures that. And we now have a process called data pooling and data mining so that all this stuff is being integrated. And most big companies can buy a CD-ROM that will identify you, your probable age, your address, your probable income, any chronic diseases you may have that would be disclosed by your pharmaceutical purchases. There are even some that make educated guesses as to whether you're straight or gay. There's a lot of stuff out there on CD-ROMs that are being sold openly to these direct marketing firms. That's why when you make a major purchase on your credit card, pretty soon the mailbox starts filling up with catalogs for that kind of stuff. So we're surrendering liberty, and the latest one that really worries me is that major firms like Walmart are now thinking instead of using the barcode to identify their inventory, they're going to put little chips, little radio transmitter chips on articles they sell, even articles of clothing. And they can be read up to several hundred feet away by a radio receiver, transmitter receiver. The concern that I'm hearing civil libertarians talk about now is, what if you buy a garment with one of those things embedded in it? Where is it? And who can track you? And if you've got furniture in your home with one of those things stuck on it somewhere, could somebody driving by determine from the radio signature of the things you've bought what you've got in your home? Now, technology is making the right to privacy kind of an illusory right anymore. And yet here's this fellow saying, basically, we may have to permit, expand search and seizure. And then he says we may have to permit extremes in the interrogation of suspected terrorists. Which means what? Torture. Now, let's get back to the issue I asked you about. You're a federal agent. You have in custody somebody who clearly knows when the next 9/11 is coming, but he won't tell you where, and you've got to know where. Are you tempted to use torture? Well, guess who would be tempted to use torture? Have you ever heard of Harvard law professor Alan Dershowitz? I personally saw him on a TV talk show say, it's time to get real. We're going to have to institutionalize torture. And here's the mechanism he proposed. If you had a situation like the one I just suggested that you as a federal officer would be facing, you go to a federal judge, you say, Judge, here's the evidence we have. The man clearly knows when 9/11 is going to happen again. He won't talk. We want a torture warrant. You know, you go to a judge and get a search warrant. Well, Dershowitz says we should establish something called a torture warrant. The judge would then allow you to torture the individual. And he says, you know, we don't want to be inhumane about this. So you sterilize the needles first because you don't want to introduce infection. Sterilize the needles first, then you put them under the fingernails. And a little of that, I guess, goes a long way. There are very few people endure that without, you know, starting to talk. Alan Dershowitz, the champion of civil rights. Now, I told you earlier, we're being compressed. We're put into a corner with this brilliant, satanic thing attacking liberty. And when Alan Dershowitz starts talking like that, the problem is getting acute. Well, Ellen put it in a kind of an interesting way, if I can find it for you, because I think you'd probably benefit from hearing it. He wrote a book called Shouting Fire. If you want to read more of this, you can get the book. It's a fairly recent book. His argument is put in these terms. If the court applied a cost-benefit analysis, the issue would be simple. The life of one guilty terrorist is surely worth less than the lives of hundreds of innocent civilians. We make that kind of trade-off all the time when we impose capital punishment, when we send soldiers to war, and when we permit the shooting of fleeing felons. Anybody want to argue with him? His logic is clear. What disturbs me is we've gotten to the point where we're facing that issue and willing to address it, willing to institutionalize, or at least talk about institutionalizing, the issue of torture once again. All right, now, where does this lead with respect to religious liberty? Now, I probably should give us a heads up here. In just a few moments, I want to be projecting for you a little clip from some very, very conservative, very concerned Roman Catholics who have looked at the country we live in today, and they have said, it's obvious things aren't going right. We have problems in America. And then they propose the reason why America's heading downhill. You'll be very interested in hearing that. Listen for what they say the source of the problem is. Before we get there, let me just share with you some statements made by some prominent religious and political thought leaders. And I'll get out of the way so we can lower the screen, because we will have to get that down to project on. Okay? Way back in 1984, Pat Robertson put it this way, there is nothing in the U.S. Constitution that sanctifies the separation of church and state. He said that phrase appears nowhere in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. Later on, 1993, he said, there's no such thing in the Constitution, it's a lie of the left, and we're not going to take it anymore. Pat Robertson speaking on the wall of separation. Reverend Criswell, who a number of years ago was the Southern Baptist Convention president, put it this way, way back in 1984. I believe this notion of the separation of church and state was the figment of some infidel's imagination. And Cardinal Bevilacqua, until very recently, was Archbishop of Philadelphia. He's recently been replaced by a new cardinal. But he expressed it in these words, if we can get a private school voucher plan through in one state, that's the foot in the door. That's what I want. I want to see it passed in one state, let it go through the courts to remove the notion of the separation of church and state. Now, you're aware that's happened. You're aware of the Zelman case in Ohio, where they were using Ohio state money or wanted to use it to fund private religious schools. There was a court action brought, and a majority of the Supreme Court said it's okay, we're going to use public money for private parochial schools. The thing we need to be thinking about there is the cost, projected cost of that for per year would be about $74 billion. That's more. We would spend more funding private schools than the entire national education budget at present in the United States. And John Paul Stevens, bless his heart, in his ringing dissent, in that case said, When you remove one brick from the wall of separation between church and state, you weaken our democracy. So there is the challenge we face. What I'm trying to point out is that in terms of liberty, we're being pushed increasingly into a corner where people are starting to be willing to give liberty away. We've already had suggestions that religious liberty is very much negotiable in the minds of a lot of people. Now, with that on your mind, think about Adventism's long-standing concern about religious liberty and the freedom of worship that allows us to be here on this day. And now, for the next 2 or 3 minutes, watch the world you live in described by your very committed, very concerned Catholic neighbors. Yeah, we can roll a tape.
Can anyone doubt that the 20th century has been under the power of the devil? Scripture teaches us that God never abandons His children. As every parent would warn their children of impending danger, God has always sent prophets to guide and protect His children. Today, the entire world is being deluged with reports of apparitions of Jesus and Mary. The messages they are giving us through chosen souls are serious, urgent, and apocalyptic. Nearly always, they are reinforced by signs and wonders. Statues weep human tears and human blood. Rose petals fall from the sky. People experience the wounds of Jesus, often referred to as the stigmata. The Eucharistic bread and wine change into real flesh and blood, and numerous celestial phenomena continue to occur. Are we witnessing the greatest hoax in the history of Christianity, or is this the real thing? Are we, as we are being told, truly living in the end times? Many of the visionaries and scholars say we are. Let's hear what they have to say. What can we expect during the coming tribulations? Is there any hope?
To the people who would, for the very first time, hear these messages that have come from the apparitions of the Virgin Mary, that have come from angels, that have come from other people who maybe have had dreams and these types of warnings, I would say to them to take a good look around the world and honestly ask themselves, what do they see? Do they see a world that's growing in love and peace, or do they see a world that's hanging by a thread?
In the 20th century, we have seen more advances in science, technology, and more social changes than we had in the previous 2,000 years. Sunday used to be the Lord's Day, a day of worship and rest from work. Today, our Sundays are crammed with chores and errands. The malls are filled with shoppers and workers. But in particular, the sports craze dominates our Sunday culture, no longer leaving any room for the sacred and the observance of the Sabbath. What has been the effect of not observing and keeping the Sabbath holy? Churches are closing, the divorce rate is exploding, and abortion on demand is the law of our land. Violence and crime have been declared a national epidemic. There are more criminals in prison today in the state of Texas alone than there were in the entire United States just 35 years ago. In this century, over 200 million people have been killed from communism and wars. 30 years ago, Americans would have burned down the schoolhouse before allowing their children to be taught that homosexuality is an acceptable lifestyle. Thousands of images of pornography, violence, and murder assault our children daily as parents leave them with television as their babysitter.
I think that gives you a little feel for where they're coming from. You notice what they did was to identify the problems in our society, very accurately identifying many of which we also feel concern about. We're on the same page there. These are good people. These are neighbors you probably would be happy to live next to, because they want nothing more than a safe neighborhood, a decent school, drug-free environment for their kids, and a country in which their future is safe. But do you notice what they propose as being the cause of our problem? We fail to keep the Sabbath holy. And when they see Sabbath, they ain't talking about the seventh day. There's the end time issue. My conviction is that end time problems will not come from bad people trying to do bad things to others. It will come from good people who are frightened, who are desperate, who are trying to get back to the good days. And in their efforts to do that, unintentionally, provoke a collapse of liberty that brings on a time of trouble such as never was. That's what we're facing today in America. I think we need to keep our national leadership much in prayer, because they face challenges that just pretty much defy human solution. And I think we're getting to the point where the only real route out of the mess we're in is straight up. Which is why we're here, and that's what we're looking for, and praise the Lord, we should remember Jesus' advice. When these things begin to happen, and they've begun to happen, we can look up, for our redemption draweth nigh.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries have been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.